Welcome to the Deep Dive. Hi, I'm Pat.
And hello, I'm Jesse.
Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into a topic that, well, often remains hidden in plain sight. Emotional abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a complex area, isn't it? One that many of us might not even realize we've experienced or witnessed, maybe even unintentionally contributed to. It's truly critical stuff.
Indeed. And our mission today really is to unpack those subtle yet profoundly damaging forms of psychological and emotional abuse.
Right.
We'll explore its impact, you know, across different relationships, partners, family, even work.
Yeah.
And importantly, look at pathways to healing, how to break these cycles. We've gathered some powerful sources, personal stories, professional research.
Lots to draw on.
Exactly. All to help you get really well informed on this.
Okay. So let's begin. It's so striking how emotional abuse often doesn't leave, you know, visible scars.
Right.
And that invisibility, it makes it incredibly hard to identify for the person going through it and for others looking in.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say emotional abuse, what exactly are we defining here?
Well, what's really fascinating and a critical distinction our sources make is that unlike, say, physical abuse, emotional abuse isn't usually a single event you can point to. It's characterized by a pattern of behavior.
A pattern. Okay.
Yeah. Sustained, repetitive. Think of it like a systematic diminishment of someone, their independence, their self-worth.
Wow.
And this constant erosion, it can lead to really severe psychological trauma like chronic anxiety, depression, even PTSD.
That definitely raises a big question then, because sometimes lines can feel blurry, right?
Absolutely.
How does just an unhealthy argument, maybe a really bad fight, differ from actual emotional abuse?
That is such a crucial distinction. An argument, even, you know, a pretty unhealthy one, it's typically bi-directional. Both people are involved. Things can pause.
Right, back and forth.
Exactly. There might be anger, sure, but a healthy resolution, ideally, involves someone taking responsibility, maybe a real apology.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional abuse, though, it's almost always unidirectional. There's a clear power imbalance, one person seeking control.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't really breaks in that dynamic. Crying might get used as leverage. Apologies, if they happen, often sound like blame or just excuses.
Yeah, like, I'm sorry you feel that way.
Precisely. And the person on the receiving end, you're left feeling just perpetually exhausted, confused, like you're constantly walking on eggshells.
That sounds incredibly confusing to live with.
Yeah.
So how does this translate into recognizing it day to day? What are some of those subtle signs that might just slip by?
Well, our sources point to a whole range of these subtle things. It could be a partner who just never asks about your day, your goals, your interests.
Like you don't matter outside of them.
Exactly. Like you're invisible.
Yeah.
Or it might be someone constantly debating or negotiating really simple boundaries you set. Like maybe you prefer a certain color cup.
You seriously?
Oh.
Over a cup.
Yeah. And they turn it into a whole thing, making you question why you even care. It undermines your right to have preferences.
Wow.
There's often this tendency to avoid direct conflict, but then they retaliate later, maybe calling you dramatic or too emotional.
No.
Or withholding affection, the silent treatment, that kind of thing.
And then there's that term we hear so much more about now, which sounds really insidious, gaslighting.
Yes, gaslighting. It's a prime and honestly deeply disturbing example of subtle emotional abuse.
How does that work?
It's psychological manipulation, pure and simple, designed to make you doubt your own sanity, your memory, your reality.
Wow.
The abuser might lie outright, deny things they definitely said or did, tell you you're imagining things or that you're crazy.
That's terrifying.
It is. One personal account we looked at described someone who was initially super charming. Right?
Mm-hmm. The charm offensive.
Totally. And they'd use these tiny criticisms about taste in music, how the flat was arranged.
Nitpicking.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then when the victim got upset, the gaslighter would flip it. You're responsible for your own emotions, they'd say. Why are you letting this bother you?
Ugh. So it chips away at your trust in yourself?
Completely. Systematically.
And it sounds like the abuser's personality, that initial charm, can be a huge part of the disguise. Like a trap.
It really can be. The sources are very clear on this. Gaslighters are often described as charismatic, charming, highly manipulative.
And they could be anyone.
Absolutely. A partner, family member, friend, coworker, even a boss or leader, anyone close.
And the truly insidious part
is that victims often don't fully get that they're being gaslit until they're out, until they talk to friends or a therapist and start piecing it together.
Because it's so confusing from the inside.
It's like a fog. A slow psychological unraveling, almost impossible to see clearly when you're in it.
Now, our sources talk about specific cycles of emotional abuse.
Yeah.
That seems helpful, giving some structure to these experiences. Can you walk us through those patterns?
Yes, certainly. The expert Sarah K. Smullins, she's codified this into five distinct cycles. Though, in reality, they often overlap and connect.
Okay.
So first, there's rage. This cycle is marked by just intense, overwhelming anger. It kind of permeates the home or the relationship.
Constant tension.
Exactly. It's so frightening, so unpredictable that people caught in it just can't think clearly. They can't trust their judgment, live in constant fear.
There was a story, Celeste's story.
Yes. A powerful example. Her mother's rage and verbal abuse were so constant, it led Celeste, as a child, to act out her anger on her own friends.
Oh, wow, repeating the pattern.
Tragically, yes. Drove them away.
Okay, what's the next cycle?
Enmeshment. This happens when parents, or maybe other authority figures, are excessively protective, overly involved.
Smothering almost.
Kind of. It makes the child feel totally crippled or incomplete without that constant support and guidance. Lionel's story showed this with his super close family, especially his sister Ellen.
Right, he felt he was constantly breaking her fall.
Exactly, carrying her emotional weight. It created this intense dependency, making it really hard for him to form other healthy relationships.
Okay. And similar but different is the next one.
Right. Extreme overprotection and overindulgence. It shares features with enmeshment, but here the focus is on shielding the child from any difficulty, any discomfort. Often involves lavishing them with stuff too.
Cushioning the road, as one source put it.
Perfectly put. Nathan, the successful lawyer,
Oh.
professionally okay, but couldn't form intimate relationships beyond his parents.
Because they'd always smoothed everything over.
Responded to every demand, left him without that emotional resilience you need for real intimacy.
Got it. Then there's rejection abandonment.
In this pattern, the parent or caregiver withdraws love, affection, attention. If the child expresses an opinion they don't like or shows any independence,
So you learn not to think for yourself.
it instills this deep fear of independent thought, leads to intense feelings of isolation. Benita, the writer.
The one who married the man who said he'd kill her before he'd let her go.
Yes, chilling, right? But her childhood rejection was so bad, so traumatic, that his possessiveness actually felt safe in a really twisted way.
Wow, that's heavy. And the last cycle.
Complete neglect. This is maybe the most stark. Parents providing little or no emotional or physical care, just absence.
April's story really brought that home.
Yes. Hospitalized after a suicide attempt, eventually adopted by foster parents who showed her what real care looked like.
That's a huge mountain to climb.
Huge. Victims often have to intentionally find and bring kind, caring people into their lives to fill that massive void. Each cycle leaves these really deep, unique scars.
It's so clear how damaging these dynamics are
Mm.
and how trapped people must feel. The long-term effects must be just devastating. What are some of the biggest impacts?
Oh, the damage is significant. Far-reaching. It just erodes a person's self-esteem, their confidence, their basic dignity.
Yeah.
It leaves you feeling worthless, powerless, unlovable, really disconnected from yourself and physically.
Shows up physically too.
Absolutely. The chronic stress, the trauma, it can manifest as all sorts of things. Fatigue, gut issues, fibromyalgia, eating disorders, substance abuse, even some studies show gynecological problems. The mind and body are definitely linked.
And the sources dig into that psychological impact, describing how the victim's perception, their reality, can get so distorted. One account called it like their mind turning to mush. That's unsettling, but feels apt. How does that happen?
Yeah, that mush description really hits home, doesn't it? This is where concepts like cognitive dissonance are so important to understand.
Okay, cognitive dissonance.
It means victims often hold two completely conflicting beliefs at the same time. For instance, my partner is wonderful and loving, and my partner is intensely abusive.
That must be agonizing.
It is. It leads to profound confusion, deep self-doubt, a terrifying loss of trust in your own memory, your own decisions.
So you start questioning everything.
Constantly. You might find yourself always apologizing, even for the abuser's behavior, or defending them to others, even when you know they're lying or hurting you. It's like a mental fog. Clear thinking becomes almost impossible.
And that idea of a trauma bond, that really speaks to the confusion too, doesn't it? It ties into that mush feeling.
Precisely. The trauma bond is, gosh, it's one of the most powerful and heartbreaking parts of emotional abuse.
How does it form?
It's this psychological attachment that grows out of the abuse cycle itself. The abuser inflicts pain,
Right.
but then they also provide moments of relief, kindness, false hope.
The highs and lows.
Exactly. And it utterly confuses your brain. You start associating the abuser with fixing the hurt they caused.
Oh, wow.
It creates this powerful, really insidious cycle where you might desperately want to go back, believing they can make it better, even though the underlying abuse pattern is still there.
So they're not really making it better.
No, they're just pausing the cruelty temporarily, creating this false security that makes leaving incredibly hard.
Which definitely helps explain why victims often stay,
yeah,
even when the harm is so clear.
Definitely. And beyond those deep psychological effects, there are often very real practical reasons, too. Financial dependence, kids, isolation.
Life circumstances trapping them.
Big factors. But fundamentally, it's also that constant dangling carrot of false promises. I'll change. I'll get help. It won't happen again.
Keeping her alive.
Exactly. And as one source noted, victims internalize the abuse. They start believing they are to blame or somehow deserve it.
Oh, that's awful.
It is. And so they try desperately to change their own behavior to please the abuser, which just increases their dependence and it makes it even harder to break free. It's a really vicious circle.
This all sounds so incredibly challenging. It must feel impossible sometimes to break free. But crucially, our sources do offer hope, a path forward. What does that journey to healing look like?
Well, the first and arguably the most vital step is recognition. Recognizing the abuse for what it is.
Naming it.
Yes. Once you truly understand and can name it, this is abuse, you can begin that difficult but liberating process of dealing with it. And it's absolutely vital to internalize this. It is not your fault.
Right. Say that again.
It is not your fault. Tolerating abuse just deepens the wounds, weakens self-esteem, keeps the cycle going. The abuser's actions are their responsibility, not yours.
Okay. So once that recognition starts to sink in, what are some practical, concrete steps people can take to rebuild their lives, their sense of self?
Rebuilding self-esteem is absolutely key. It's a cornerstone of recovery.
How do you do that?
It involves actively recognizing your own strengths, you know, practicing positive self-talk. Using affirmations intentionally to counteract all those negative messages you've absorbed, focusing on your needs, your desires, your well-being instead of just the abusers is also critical. It's a huge shift.
From self-neglect to self-care.
Exactly. Practicing self-compassion, using grounding exercises maybe for trauma flashbacks to help you stay present, and creating a strong, healthy support system. Trusted people who validate you. That makes an enormous difference. Journaling too. Can be a really powerful private tool. Helps validate your feelings, your memories, confirm your reality.
And therapy, that seems to come up again and again as almost essential in the healing process. How does that fit in?
Yes, absolutely. Therapy is often a cornerstone. Individual group therapy. It offers a safe, structured space.
A validating space.
Totally validating. To process the trauma, develop healthy coping strategies, and challenge those pathogenic beliefs.
There's harmful ideas the abuse installed.
Exactly. Those deep-seated harmful ideas about yourself or the world. It's about breaking free from that unconscious pull to repeat painful patterns.
Yeah.
Sometimes called repetition compulsion.
Right. Where you might seek out similar situations.
Yeah. Your brain trying to somehow fix the past.
Right.
Therapy helps you move towards conscious repetition identification. Understanding the patterns empowers you to choose freedom.
Choose healthier relationships.
Based on mutual respect, trust, real care, the experience of people in group therapy like April, it showed how just receiving compassion from others can be incredibly healing. It helps you develop an emotional sense of direction, as one source put it, and realize, you know, what a glorious thing it is to give and receive healthy connection. It's a journey of rediscovery.
That really does sound like a profound journey, reclaiming your life, your dignity, yourself. This has been a truly illuminating deep dive into emotional abuse, its subtle signs, those destructive cycles, and the incredible strength it takes to heal. We've touched on how it can just erode dignity and self-worth, but also how awareness, self-compassion, support, they can lead to real personal growth and freedom.
Yeah. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, just recognizing these patterns, whether it's in your own life or someone you care about, or even just in, you know, society.
Right.
That recognition is a powerful act of self-preservation, of compassion. It lets you transform what feels like unavoidable pain into an actual opportunity for growth, for freedom.
So what does this all mean for you? Listening. It means the conversations we have, the boundaries we set or don't set, the behaviors we tolerate. They profoundly shape our well-being, our future. What stands out to you from all this? How might these insights maybe reshape how you approach your relationships or how you could support someone around you? That's all for this deep dive. We really hope this has been insightful for you.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Please be sure to come back for our next deep dive. And if this was helpful, please like, share it, leave a comment. We really do appreciate hearing your thoughts.
Goodbye, everyone.